Iku'u y Luna. Please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuliana imua okea aha, ho'okolo kolo ki eki hanohano oko moko aina o Hawaii. E nai mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention, you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Velina, makamoku puni o Oahu I ka moku o kona e ano kako ma ali o lani hale. Greetings on the island of Oahu in the district of Kona. We are gathered here at Ali'iolani Hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-25-0000531. Nova Burns et al. Plaintiffs Appellees versus Hawaiian Electric Company Incorporated, doing business as Hawaiian Electric et al. Defendants Appellees, and Ace American Insurance Company et al. Intervenor Subrogation Plaintiffs Appellants. Arguing for Appellants, Ace American Insurance Company et al., Adam Romney. Also appearing is Vincent Rabiteau. Arguing for Appellees, Nova Burns et al., Terrence Revere. Arguing for Appellees, Hawaiian Electric et al., Ginger Anders. Argument on the merits.
Aloha kakahiaka and good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel and on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our substitute justices in this case, Judge Kevin Morikone and Judge Taryn Tomasa. Mahalo for your participation. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. Just to confirm, Mr. Romney, I understand you will argue for 20 minutes, then reserve your remaining time for rebuttal. Mr. Revere and Ms. Anders, you will each have 15 minutes with a 3-minute warning. And to clarify, members of the court were handed documents this morning that apparently Mr. Revere had planned to argue, and the court will not allow any argument on these new documents. So at this time, Mr. Romney, please proceed.
Thank you. First of all, it's nice to see you all again. I know we were here last year, and I want to start by acknowledging that we were all here. We all heard you. Like we had the case. We came up here. We argued about subrogation rights, and we got the message. You know, we understand that everybody wants global resolution. They truly want to resolve all of the claims for the aggregate amount that was agreed to, you know, by the settling parties. We are not trying to stop that. We are not trying to prevent that settlement from occurring or any subset of settlements from occurring. So do you need me to stand closer?
Yes, please step. Please okay. Stand closer.
All right. I'm at the locus point of the echo. So
the volume audio on this side is not as good as over there.
Okay. I'll try to keep that in mind. So we understand that everybody wants a global resolution of claims. We get it. We want that too. We are not trying to block anything. We are trying to participate and actually have a resolution so that we aren't here again for some other reason next year. And so the reason that I'm bringing this up immediately is that it's obvious that that is the animating principle or the fear that motivated not just the trial court's order, sort of a belief that we had to be shut out of all processes in order to protect a settlement procedure, but it's also the overwhelming theme of the opposition briefs that you've received. Is a statement that we are constantly trying to block some settlement or that we're trying to prevent people from getting paid. That's not true. We want this to be over as much as anybody, and we think that we can do it. I think we've signaled to you as explicitly as we possibly can. So what we are here about is a distinct subset of claims. its claims where our insureds never participated in any way in pursuing their own claims. They've never attempted to initiate a lawsuit. They've never hired a lawyer. They've never gone. And at this point, after the expiry of the claim submission date for the class action, they will never have submitted any claim to the class. They are people who have never sought a recovery. They are people who will never receive a direct recovery, ever. For that subset of claims, our reading of the matter of Maui fire cases is that those are our independent subrogation claims. Our understanding of what happened here last year is this court tried to strike a balance. It went out of its way to say it was not eliminating subrogation in general, and instead was trying to say, under these circumstances, when your insured has sought their own claim, they're going to receive an award that you can attach a lien to, you don't have an independent subrogation right, it's reduced to a lien. If those things don't exist, if they never pursue their claim, it's your independent subrogation right. And we took this court at its word for that. Now, I understand that this court may not have understood the interactions of that and how it might interact with class actions, because the class action settlement at the time the reserve questions proceeding was initiated was out in a different forum. It was out in federal court. But this is the ultimate implication of that, is that there is a significant number of claims. We currently estimate it to be about $1 billion, and we explained that in our briefing. For which this is the case. There has never been any pursuit of a claim at all.
Mr. Romney, how was the class defined when it was in federal court, when the action was in federal court?
I believe it was identically defined to how it was defined here. So what that means relevant to this action is that it was specifically excluded subrogation interests, specifically excluded subrogating insurers. Obviously, that changed in effect. So we are still excluded from the class, but what has happened is that the settlement agreement itself purports to release our claims. We are defined as class plaintiff releasors, which is how we get into the situation where we are not members of the class, and according to the other settling parties in the trial court, we're not allowed to have any due process rights, we're not allowed to have any objections, we're not allowed to say that you can't settle our claims outside of the class action procedure.
But I guess specifically as to injured parties, the class, even when it was in federal court and then when it was filed initially in the Second Circuit, that included individuals who may not have hired an attorney yet or asserted a specific claim on behalf of themselves? Question mark. Is that the case?
That's my understanding, yes. And obviously, I believe class counsel can tell you about how the definition changed over time, because there were, for example, the initial draft of when this was filed in state court did not have an exclusion for subrogation claims. We actually reached out to class counsel and said, did you intend to try to assert our claims? They said no. And then during the amendment, they excluded us from the claims. And that's one of the reasons why we did not think we were necessarily part of the class action proceeding until we got, you know, relatively far down the line where we had this decision, is that we'd had these representations from class counsel that our claims aren't part of that. It's only when we see the settlement agreements and we start seeing that the process is to release all of our claims as part of the class that we realize that, oh, they are trying to impact our rights, even though we are excluded from the class definition. And that would truly be unique. There are no examples in the United States, under federal court, any state court, of an instance in which a class action has been used to extinguish the rights of a non-class member while affording them no due process rights. This would be the first. And that should give this court pause. Part of the reason that we have those due process rights and protections in the first place is because there's a lot of danger inherent to saying we are going to adjudicate your rights and give you no forum in which to discuss whether your rights are being adjudicated fairly or actually in your interest.
I mean, aren't you really just arguing that pretty much in the class action context, you're going to have intervention by right in every single class action?
No, because I don't think that the class, so maybe if the class action like this one was specifically structured to list subrogating plaintiffs as non-parties and also release their rights. And it says, for the release, it says, for the avoidance of doubt, the release applies to subrogation insurers. That's a pretty specific scenario. And that is why we are saying that this settlement is purposely structured in order to prejudice our rights of recovery, which is against the text, the explicit text of the Matter of Maui Fire Cases opinion that this court wrote last year. That was the balance you all tried to strike.
Well, wasn't it contingent upon settlement and recovery? And once there was settlement, then your lien remedy is triggered. That's your exclusive remedy?
Well, so it was triggered on two things. First was that pursuit of claim, because that's that pursuit, that activity in which the insured is attempting to get their own claim.
Is it really pursuit, or wasn't the settlement itself the key, not pursuit in competition?
Well, I believe that the exact quote from the case described it as pursuit. It's where an injured insured does not pursue a civil action against the tortfeasor. An insurer remains free to pursue their own subrogation claim. I would say that pursuit does matter, because pursuit is what creates that competition that the court was concerned about. In the absence of any activity by the insured, if the insured has managed to go 2 years and avoided participating despite blankets advertising all over the island and being mailed class submission forms and told you have to do it by this date, pursued the claim.
I'm confused. You're arguing that class members are not pursuing a claim?
That is correct. I believe that we discussed this at length in our brief, that actually class members are not parties for all purposes, and no circuit court in the country has said they are. The United States Supreme Court opinion, Devlin versus Scardelletti, says that the party status isn't a defined static thing. It depends on the context of what you're describing. So class members, for example, aren't parties for purposes of like the magistrate judge statute. They're not parties for purposes of determining diversity jurisdiction. They're not parties for many purposes. Ultimately, we also cited
precedent. Aren't they parties for purposes of sharing in the class settlement?
So they are not parties for purposes of sharing in the class settlement unless and until they have actually make a claim against the class settlement. They are subject to the bar on claims, but basically told that you can't pursue your claim if you have never submitted you haven't objected, you haven't opted out, and you haven't submitted a claim by a certain date. However, that makes it clear in our context that insureds who have not done any of those things have never pursued a claim, and they are not in any practical competition with their insurer funds.
Well, you know, getting back to the recovery and the language that you quoted from our case, I mean, we did preserve, you know, insurer subrogation rights when there is no recovery from the tortfeasor. That's there. And I think that's the language you were just reciting.
Yes.
More or less. But doesn't the entitlement to recover from the settlement fund constitute recovery from the tortfeasor?
No, it does not. Because what you're describing then is a difference in scope. Like in the case that you all wrote last year, you described it as it's when they get a payment. It says when the insured is made to receive a direct payment from the tortfeasor, because that's what creates a fund for a lien to attach to.
Okay, but that's then when we get to the nuance of a class action, which this is, right?
Correct.
Okay. So again, the class members, now aside from probably the non-claiming class members, they're recovering, right?
They are not recovering. They are subject to the bar saying they cannot bring another action because they failed to submit a claim. But many class members who fail to submit a claim will never receive a dollar. They will never receive anything. They will not make a recovery. So there is nothing to pursue, assert a lien against. And that's the problem. And we did cite some cases from the federal.
But again, do you think there's a difference between the entitlement to recover versus the actual recovery?
Yes, and I think that that is what the text of Matter of Maui Fire Cases say. All insureds have an entitlement to recover from the moment that the tort happens. It is only when they pursue a claim and receive a payment from the tortfeasor that the subrogation right is reduced to a lien. The mere fact that you have an entitlement to recovery is irrelevant to that analysis, because everyone starts with an entitlement to recovery. If we were to adopt that analysis, that's the same. That would do what this court refused to do, Matter of Maui Fire Cases, and reduce all subrogation claims to liens.
So that brings me back to what I had said a few minutes ago, that, I mean, it seems that essentially in the class action context, you're going to have an intervention by right almost all the time, don't you?
So I guess it's possible that I'm misunderstanding what you are asking. I think that in this particular class action, yes, there is intervention by right. I can imagine there being class actions that don't involve subrogation interests. You know, because like, there's, for example, there's like civil rights class actions that are like uninsurable losses. I don't think that with like an insurer.
What about a mass tort class action?
A mass tort class action?
There's always going to be people who don't submit claims. Would you agree?
I would agree with that. And I think that I don't understand why that would change the analysis. I think that the point that we are trying to get to is to say that that is a definable universe of claims where we are now. Because where we are now, we know we can say who are all of our insureds. We can compare notes with everybody who submitted an individual settlement agreement, everyone who submitted a claim to the class, and whatever the remainder is, say that is our claims under matter of Maui fire cases. And we believe that the way that the settlements are structured, where there is this other fund, this holdback fund of $500 million set aside for the purpose of settling claims for people who are not class members and didn't sign a individual settlement agreement, that's us, we can settle within that amount. That is consistent with both matter of Maui fire cases and consistent with the structure of the settlement agreements. So you do not have to throw anything out to preserve that independent subrogation right. Like the way in which it was written in this by this court last year functions to preserve this settlement and functions to preserve the social goods that come along with subrogation.
Is your ability to get into the holdback fund monies really implicated right now by what we're arguing here? Or is that just a sort of a suggestion that it's not truly a global settlement?
Well, it is implicated by it because the function of making the release in the class action apply to all subrogating insurers, irregardless of whether our insured submitted a claim, is to exclude us from that holdback fund. It means that we have no ability to even negotiate or come to a settlement. It artificially, structurally constrains us to that smaller $190 million fund. And I'm sure that you all can do math. We have $1 billion in claims. It's actually less than 190. It's 119. Sorry. That fund.
I saw that, and you guys say you're willing to take half a mil and call it a day, right? Half a bill.
Well, no, it's not, because obviously there's a number of claims that are, it's going to be less than that, because there's a number of claims that they were like opted out of the class, for example. I think it's a little over a dozen, 16 or 17. Those people are going to recover from the same holdback fund. We're not going to ask for all of it. And honestly, we're going to do the math. We'll compare notes. We'll figure out what makes sense for everybody. But the point is that holdback fund is part of the benefit of the bargain that everybody struck. It was anticipated that there would be $500 million set aside to settle exactly these kinds of claims. And so the idea that structurally we are being forced to release our claims and also denied access to the holdback fund and also denied any opportunity in court, while the people who are trying to limit our rights say they represent us, represent our interests, is obviously designed to be prejudicial to us. Like, that is the point, is to lock us out of process.
I'm a little confused. Why can't you enforce your lien rights?
Well, for example, for people who never make a recovery, because they never do, we're not individual plaintiffs, and also they never submit a claim to the class, they never receive an award from the fund. There is nothing to attach a lien to.
So you're saying you have to intervene?
We're saying that we have a protectable legal interest based on matter of Maui fire cases, and this is our only way to protect those interests, because if we don't intervene, our rights will be released even though we are not class members.
What about mortgage lenders?
What about mortgage lenders?
Don't they also have a right to equitable subrogation?
That is a different kind of subrogation, I believe, that you're describing. That is what we are describing is involving property and casualty insurance rights, stems from a different juridical background. So the mortgage lender analogy, I don't think, applies here.
So, Mr. Romney, our case that were issued last year, one of the ideas too, or principles, was that the statutory framework prevents insurers from interfering with third-party settlements, and that's not something that, I mean, so if you are clients are allowed to intervene, isn't that what will happen? That you will attempt to address amounts that you are able to obtain, and therefore it would interfere with a third-party settlement?
No, the third-party settlement includes, it contemplates, everyone understood and negotiated that there would be this $500 million that needed to be set aside to resolve those claims. We've told you very explicitly, we can operate within that. That is actually participating under the terms they negotiated. It's not interfering with it.
So at bottom line, rather than just the $135 million pool, you're just talking about being able to access a larger pool of funds to assert your lien rights.
Our independent subrogation rights as to people who have not pursued their own claims.
Okay.
So we would have our lien rights for people who did pursue their own claims and received a recovery. They have something to attach a lien to. For those who did not pursue their own claims, we would have our subrogation rights, and we would.
But wouldn't that undo the settlement?
It would not undo the settlement. And actually, one of the things that we have never heard, because remember that the settlement as it is, remember, it's an aggregate amount of a little over $4 billion. It isn't like a single document. There is no document that exists that says global settlement on it. What we are saying is that we can make sure that we will settle it for the same aggregate amount. And what we've never heard is why that would make the defendants, for example, the people who are providing the money and the release, any worse off. It obviously wouldn't. They wouldn't pay a dollar more. They wouldn't be subject to any additional terms. They would get the exact benefit of their deal. They would get the global resolution they say they want. So we can preserve the settlement. That's why we are trying to say we aren't trying to block anything. We just want a seat at the table. And that's what was denied to us by saying that we have no rights at all, have no right to intervene.
Well, going back to protectable interest, I mean,
yes.
Can you tell me how there's a protectable interest in your equitable subrogation rights when there is simply a class member's possible failure to file claims, those non-claiming members? I mean, it seems we're looking at the intervention stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just seems like it's a potentiality.
So first of all, there's 2 points I want to make on that before I have to reserve time. First is, what you are describing is a reason why the trial courts claim that we didn't file timely is unsupportable. Is because there are some cases that say you need to figure out the exact extent to which the settlement affects your rights before it's even ripe to intervene. And what the Supreme Court and what the trial court said is that we were too late to intervene, even though that potentiality is where we were at. We tried to intervene at the earliest possible stage. So that's an example of the heads I win, tails you lose logic that's designed to keep us out. The second thing that I would say to that is that where we stand now is no longer a potentiality because the claims bar date and the claims submission date has already passed. That's why it should be easy for us, if we were to compare notes, to determine exactly which claims we paid out for under our policies of insurance that do not relate, cannot be matched to any person who has already settled their claim and pursued the claim. That is not a potentiality. It's a definable and determinable set of claims. And with that, I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Revere?
Thank you. May it please the court, Terry Revere for the class plaintiffs. When I was getting ready for the hearing, I was looking at the reply memo on page 1 of the reply memo, and they say one thing that is true and one thing that is astonishingly misleading. The thing that they said is that is true is they said, last year this court held that HRS 663-10 limits a property and casualties insurer's rights to the assertions of liens when an insured recovers by settlement or judgment against the tortfeasor. We have a settlement. We have a judgment. So that alone completely destroys this appeal for them. That's the situation that we are in. And given the Maui Fires case, the opinion, the only reason we are here is because they know if the class settlement goes away, then the whole thing goes away. And that is why they are trying to throw monkey wrenches once again. All of their
aside from that point, and I don't think that point is neither here nor there for us.
Okay.
tell me about the protectable interest.
Yeah, they don't have one based upon the Maui fires case and the plain language of 663-10. Their whole case is this fulcrum that 663-10, which says any civil action, you do the drill that those of us who defended auto cases, for example, have done hundreds of times. There might be a lien by the state of Hawaii or some doctor. And then you go, okay, negotiate that lien or do the 663-10 process. That is completely protected under this class settlement. That's their remedy. That's where they have to go. They just don't want to. And that's the problem, is there's no difference between a class plaintiff or an individual plaintiff. That is the process that 663.
They're tethering it to non-claiming class members, though.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. So one of the points we wanted to make is what they are, and this falls into, again, going back to page one, the frankly astonishing misrepresentation that's been made to this court, which is, gosh, you know, there's this December deadline for people to get their information, and that deadline has come and passed. What they're not telling the court is they took advantage of that process 3,800 times. For the very people that they're saying, oh, they didn't fill out their paperwork, they were allowed under our process that if you've got an insured who's sitting there like a bump on the log, we allowed them to assert the claim on behalf of their insured. And another interesting thing that was said in the, by this court is it's not only the tort victim that can affect subrogation rights and having it resolved in the 663-10 process. The insurer asserting those claims can affect that right by acting inconsistent, which is what they are doing, because they are asserting claims under that class process and they're trying to have their cake and eat it too by coming to this court.
So I think what you're referring to is you're referring to the 4.1.2K settlement agreement provisions where they can make claims?
Correct.
What about the July 25th settlement plan that has no procedures whatsoever for them to assert those claims?
They do have that. They do have that. That is part of the settlement agreement. They are allowed to step into the shoes for these
I understand that, okay. But the settlement agreement references a settlement plan. Subrogating insurers suggested that settlement plan has no procedures, no process for them to step into those shoes.
Yeah.
Is that correct or not?
It is absolutely not correct, and they are in fact doing it and have done it at least 3,800 times already. So when they say, oh gosh, we can't do anything, it's not true. And if they, and there's also the other thing that's getting a little bit lost in the shuffle of their arguments, there are class members that have no insurance at all. Their settlements are being held up by these guys. And they also act like they are infants. These insurers know
can
it.
Can I clarify something, or have you clarify something then? Is there an omission or not in the settlement plan with respect to procedures and process?
Yes, and it's the same process, and this is all a court-supervised process for before Judge Cahill to allow them to go through a 663-10 process, just like an independent plaintiff goes through. So they're saying, oh, we're just stuck. It just isn't true, and they just keep on repeating that same misrepresentation. So I think there's two things they're in denial over. One is Rule 2 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. It says there's one form of action called a civil action. And 663-10 says any civil action, this is the drill you go through. You assert your lien rights via that process. Mr. Romney said, in any event, one of the points I wanted to make was they have affected their own, they don't have a right of subrogation, but even if they did, by going through the class process as they have affected their own subrogation process. Mr. Romney started off by saying, hey, we got the message. They clearly didn't get the message because they are trying to, there's no point of them bringing this case other than to try to blow up both settlement agreements. They misrepresent that they were, quote, shut out of the process. There's a well-worn area of the carpet with subrogation attorneys argue in front of Judge Cahill constantly in the Second Circuit Court. He allowed them to argue. He considered their objections. He denied their intervention, but he heard their objections on the merits, and he rejected them anyway. So They weren't shut out of the process. They've had tons of due process. And they did have a forum, obviously, for that. Also, the cases where they say, well, a class member isn't treated as a party, that's true. If you have a class of 10,000 people and the class counsel and defense counsel say, we'll do a magistrate trial, you can't have a class plaintiff say, I want an Article III judge for those purposes. But we have a certified class approved by the court. They are definitely bound. And just to give an example of the people that aren't making the claims, even though they are actually making the claims for the people in the class. Yeah, I've had a condo case where they, against a roofing manufacturer, and the roofing manufacturer sent a settlement out that says the number of square footage in your building, you get a payment based on the number of square footage. There's a settlement, it's there, and if the condo board sits there and just for whatever reason says, oh, we're not going to bother filling out the paperwork, well, you might not get paid, but it doesn't mean you're not bound by that settlement because you won't go through the drill. And they have cooperation clauses. They could have brought these claims at any time if they had a significant subrogation claim, they felt their insured wasn't doing anything, invoke the arbitration clause, get the case settled that way. And they're also acting like, oh, they're just, they couldn't do it earlier because they had to find out what their rights were. They're writing checks every day. They know what the rights are. They know, hey, Mrs. Jones got a check for 10 grand or whatever. They knew exactly what they were talking about. Your Honors, I don't have anything further unless Your Honors have any question. I'd yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Anders?
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Ginger Anders, arguing for the defendants. So this court should reject the insurer's attempt to intervene here because they are trying to assert subrogation rights that this court held in Maui fires that they don't have. I think it's key that the only protectable interest they have ever asserted here throughout this process is one in subrogation rights. But just last year, this court held that 663.10 and 431.13 together established that subrogation rights yield to a settlement by operation of law, and the insurers therefore have no right to object to at any point in litigation to a settlement on the ground that it prejudices subrogation rights.
So if unless I could, it's in bad faith.
That's exactly right. There will be a good faith hearing. That will happen. That is to come in this proceeding. So if I could just sort of spin out how I think these statutes work here and address questions about the non-claiming plaintiffs. So going to the text of 431.13, it operates to eliminate subrogation rights where damages are recovered by judgment or settlement. This is a class action. We have a settlement here. It is a class settlement, operates at the class level. We have a class-wide recovery for $135 million in damages. That is a settlement for damages that satisfies 431.13 and eliminates subrogation rights as to every plaintiff who is in that settlement. So then I think, and I don't understand the insurers really to dispute the idea that the class settlement itself does eliminate subrogation rights and make lien rights exclusive as to at least some plaintiffs. So once that's the case, then the only question is, are the plaintiffs who don't end up claiming from the settlement fund, should we think about them as being not part of the settlement somehow, as though they were opt-outs, or should we think of them as still part of the settlement? And I think that answer is very clear. These are plaintiffs, these are class plaintiffs, they're part of the class action. They were damaged by the fires like everyone else. The class mechanism obviously exists to enable plaintiffs like that who might not otherwise want to be active litigants to eventually recover. They received notice that they were plaintiffs. They declined to opt out. That means they are plaintiffs for purposes of settlement. They are bound by the settlement. They released their claims in the settlement, and they received an entitlement to claim part their portion of the class recovery. So for all those reasons, I think there's no question that they are part of the class.
But the insurer's argument is that the class settlement and the structure of the process is aimed to prevent them from actually from essentially undermining their subrogation rights, right? I mean, that's a manufactured method of precluding them from pursuing their subrogation rights, where somebody has not actually, an injured party has not actually recovered anything, and therefore there is no ability to assert a lien against under the statutes, right? So that's their argument. What is very interesting to me is this the idea that under the settlement process, class action settlement process, that the insurers are purportedly able to assert claims for those individuals who are injured who have not actually asserted it on their own. Can you address that further, please?
Sure. So taking that in steps, I first want to push back a little bit against the idea that this is a manufactured class action.
Right, that's the argument.
Yeah, these classes were filed in the immediate aftermath of the fires. Again, the class mechanism is designed for, obviously some of these people were active litigants, but the class is designed to allow.
And to be clear, the class action was filed well before our opinion last year.
Yes, this proceeded contemporaneously with the individual actions, and the parties have designed this to try to be complementary so that there isn't duplication between the two. But with respect to the lien right in particular, again, there is a class-wide recovery here, and there is a settlement, and so for that reason, I think 431.13 clearly eliminates subrogation rights. But then, because there is a class action, there is a question. You have to disaggregate the class recovery so that each plaintiff recovers individually, and the liens, of course, are asserted plaintiff by plaintiff. And so that process, I think, simply raises the question of how do we adequately protect the lien right, so for purposes of 663.10. And so what the parties have done here in the settlement agreement is to say that a person's recovery, a plaintiff's recovery, is entirely agnostic to whether they had an insurance recovery or not, and the insurers will be able to claim assert liens against that recovery. And in the event that somebody doesn't ultimately file the paperwork to claim their portion of the settlement recovery, the insurer can assert that claim on behalf of the insured. And so that is the process that my friend was saying has already occurred.
And there's no limitation to that group of claimants compared to other claimants who actually would have individually or on their own made those claims against the class?
Not at all. Those will be treated the same in lien process. It's simply that the insurer has made the claim on their behalf, and then the court ultimately will determine as part of the lien process how that works. So for that reason, I think there's no possible argument here that the insurer's lien rights have been prejudiced, which I think goes back to the fact that they're asserting subrogation rights rather than lien rights here, that they don't have subrogation rights by operation of the statutes we've been talking about and also the Maui fires case. And I just want to address the idea that they've been sort of shut out from the process here. I think nothing could be further from the truth. The question whether they have a protectable interest is a legal question that is fully vetted here that we would urge the court to resolve, particularly because it is going to come up again in the context of the insurer's direct subrogation actions. They have asserted direct subrogation as to non-claiming plaintiffs. Those claims have been dismissed. The insurers have appealed that. So the same issue is going to arise again. So we would urge the court to address the protectable interest issue here in order to help further
And how would you suggest we address the protectable interest?
Well, I think what the court should say here is what it said in Maui Fires, which is that an insurer release of claims by settlement does not prejudice an insurer because an insurer does not have subrogation rights to begin with. Those rights yield by operation of sections 431.13 and 663.10 upon settlement. That means, and this court said it over and over again in Maui Fires, that at no point in the litigation can the insurer come in and say, I object to this settlement on the ground that it prejudices my subrogation rights. I think that's quite clear from the opinions. I don't think there's any way consistent with that opinion to hold that they have a protected interest in intervening to assert subrogation.
And the subrogation rights, you kind of mentioned or alluded to sort of the switcheroo, perhaps, that they are now suggesting that there's the lien rights versus the subrogation rights. Can you expand a little bit on that?
So, as Your Honor is referring to the assertion in the reply brief that they haven't been able to make claims. So I agree with Mr. Revere. My understanding, and the defendants are not directly involved in that, but my understanding is that that is inaccurate. They have been asserting claims through the claims process. And while I think the claims settlement plan that Your Honor referred to was somewhat high level, the parties did work out how this process would go in conjunction with the court. But to the extent...
I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
Finish your thought.
Just quickly, to the extent that the insurers are now, for the first time in their reply brief, attempting to say we have a protectable interest in a lien right here, which of course they do have protectable interest in their lien rights, to the extent that they are now trying to assert that as a basis for intervention, that is forfeited many times over because, of course, they have been very clear all the way along that they're asserting only subrogation rights because they would prefer to have subrogation rights here. And I also think it is clearly untimely. The circuit court did dismiss the intervention motion on timeliness grounds. That's not an abuse of discretion. I'm not asking the court to rule solely on that, but I think the idea that they would inject assertion about lien rights in their reply brief before this court, clearly untimely.
When were the class, there were three separate class actions in federal court, correct?
I believe that's.
Do you know when they were filed?
So they were originally filed in state court. They were
and then removed, right?
And then they were removed federal court. I believe that was in 2024. Essentially, as part of the settlement, everybody agreed that they should go back to state court in order to be able to implement the settlement, and that happened.
So you're indicating that they do have an interest in their lien rights, but that's not what they asserted.
That's not what they've been asserting the whole time. Certainly, I think 6310 establishes that they would have an interest in the protection of their lien rights, and I suspect the reason they're not asserting that here is that the settlement agreement does fully protect those rights, and that is section 4.1.2K that we've been discussing, that it ensures at every step that they will be able to assert those lien rights.
Absent that provision, would their position be well-founded?
Well, I think if they were attempting to intervene on the ground that they had a protectable interest in lien rights, I do think that an insurer in that situation would be able to say the settlement needs to adequately protect my lien rights. Maui Fires said that. I think that as a hypothetical is something that an insurer could say when faced with a settlement like this. They haven't said that here, and there's no possible argument that the lien rights aren't protected here because the settlement
does. Was that even raised before Judge Cahill?
I'm sorry?
That issue about protecting lien rights versus the subrogation rights, was that even raised before?
No, it was not raised before Judge Cahill, so I think it would be both forfeited and untimely. It would be deeply prejudicial at this point for the insurers to raise that.
Let me ask you something. I mean, and Mr. Romney sort of mentioned, you know, how are you folks adequately representing us? I mean, do you still contend that there's adequate and I know you're defendants. So I should have probably asked this to your colleague or semi-colleague here at least. What do you think about the adequate representation? I mean, you pretty much, not you again, but, you know, the class piece pretty much tried to eliminate subrogation rights. It doesn't seem like there's an adequate representation there. Do you have any position on that?
So I guess my view on adequate representation is that you have to ask whether there's adequate representation with respect to the protectable interest. So in other words, that factor rises and falls with the protectable interest here. So they have no protectable interest in subrogation rights. I think so we're done for intervention purposes. Now, if they were asserting lien rights, I think that 66310 actually does align the interests of the plaintiffs and the insurers because it gives them both an interest in maximizing recovery because, of course, the plaintiffs want to maximize the chance that they'll be fully compensated. The insurers want to maximize whatever they would take in liens off of that recovery. And so the cases say that when both parties sort of share, when one has a derivative claim and they both share an interest in maximizing recovery, then the party adequately represents the intervener. So I think that's how it would work under 66310. Of course, I think we don't get to that point because they haven't, their subrogation rights are not a protectable interest here. If there are no further questions.
All right, and no further questions, thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Romney.
So. All right. I want to raise address a few things that were brought up during their presentation. First of all, Justice Edens, the question that you were asking about the difference between the settlement terms and the settlement plan, I believe that we gave the documents and cited the pages from the settlement plan. I believe that we provided the settlement plan as part of our exhibits. There is nothing about how to submit such a claim. It doesn't exist. What happened in practice is that their website had a
if you want to submit a subrogation claim on behalf of an insurer, email this email address, which we did because we're trying to do everything we can to protect our rights. And there were no procedures. We got an email back saying, like, so what do you think should happen? There was nothing in the plan saying what to do. And there was no plan. They seemed to be surprised that we emailed them. So furthermore, the question, they alluded to this in their brief. They said that was under question 20 in their FAQ. It was 20.
Right, Vince.
Yeah. That's that question that they apparently just added that was never approved by the trial courts. There appears to have been an attempt to sort of manufacture the appearance of a claims process for us, but that claims process does not exist. It's never existed. It is. But when he says that we've submitted claims, we've just said, here's what we got. We're, you know, but there is no actual procedure. We're just trying to say, in the event that this does not go our way, we want to make it clear that you don't say we forfeited it by not sending you our documents. That's all that happened. There was no procedure. It was not planned. Justice Ginoza, you were interested in the process for submitting claims on behalf of the insureds.
Right.
So I think the important thing to keep in mind with that is that, again, that process that they are describing, the insured is never involved because they have never submitted a claim on their own. They are not participating. They're not in contact with it. So what's actually happening is the insurer is getting up all of our documents. We're collecting what we paid, and then we submit what we paid. And then the fund is going to essentially send us a check. That is not a lien. That's an outright award. Now, they try to say, well, no, it's really going to them, and then you assert a lien. That's a mirage. That's a mirage, because if the insured is not involved in the process at all, we're the only ones who submit a claim, we're the only ones making a recovery, that is an award. And so that is what makes us fundamentally a member of the class without having any of the due process rights afforded to class members.
Are the attorneys class members?
The attorneys are not class members, no. The class members are defined only as the insureds.
All right.
And are the mortgage lenders class members?
No. Your question that you asked earlier about mortgage lenders, I think there may be a terminology confusion about the difference between subrogation and subordination of mortgages.
Okay.
So the mortgage lenders are not involved in this at all. Does that help?
All right. In terms of you are claiming equitable subrogation rights only on behalf of insureds that are not submitting claims, correct?
Have not submitted claims to the class and also did not sign an individual settlement agreement. Like, we have their own lawyer and recover from that fund. That is our understanding.
And you're saying that they're not a part of the settlement?
Yeah, they have not participated at all. They have never. Actually, when you say a part of the settlement, I want to be clear about this because this goes to what the defendants were arguing. There is a difference between being a party to the settlement and pursuing a claim and having your claims barred because you failed to submit a claim. So we are not saying that those people can come back later and submit a claim. We're not asking any of that to be renegotiated. What we are saying is it can be defined and determined that they never pursued a claim. They will never receive money upon which we can assert a lien. And that, in that instance, we have independent subrogation rights that we are willing to settle within the holdback fund. So Mr. Revere's statements that I don't know how I could be clearer about this. Do you have any idea how embarrassing it would be for me to be back here next year after I've told you that we will settle all of these claims and preserve this settlement framework, and then it doesn't happen, and then I have to explain that? It's going to get done. This idea that we're trying to disrupt everything and prevent the settlement from occurring is just false. That's just wrong.
So Mr. Rodney, from a practical perspective, what's the difference in terms of if you have the ability to seek these amounts that your clients have paid in insurance benefits through this class settlement process where you've submitted apparently through a website the amounts that you have paid out? What is the difference between that in terms of your protectable interests as opposed to if the insured had in fact individually asserted a claim on their own?
Sure. So there's two pieces to that. First of all, the practical difference is $500 million.
that's $500 million that is not available to us if it is entirely released all the way through.
Well, but that's getting to what the amount of the settlement should be, right? And whether you should be in this pocket versus this pocket.
That's the categorization. But yes, I mean, that is a way in which the trial court's ruling fundamentally impacted our protectable interests, is because it said that these funds, which we estimated $1 billion for these claims, can be reduced to nearly nothing, pennies on the dollar. And that is obviously an issue. The second thing, then we talk about our protectable legal interests, is this is where I want to get be really clear about this. What they are doing is creating a subclass. They're creating a class of members in which we submit a claim on behalf of our insureds, then we receive an award. So all of our claims are released, we're bound by the class, but we are not entitled to any of the procedural protections that are given to class members. So we are class members for purposes of all of the detriments applied to us. We are class members for purposes of being bound by numbers that are negotiated on our behalf that we don't have any input into. But we are not allowed to opt out of it and say that we want to participate in the holdback fund instead, like any other class member. We're not allowed to object to any portion of the settlement. And that is dangerous. That creation of a subclass, which is bound by the settlement but is not given any rights, is something that will be used in the future. If this court agrees to allow it in this instance, it will show up again. And it's going to show up in an instance where someone wants to resolve a claim, and someone who is politically unpowerful or unpalatable will be the person who is on the downside of this. It'll be used in land rights cases. It'll be used in water rights cases. That is dangerous.
Ultimately, in terms of approving a class settlement, however, I mean, it's overseen by the trial court judge. And one of the things that the trial court judge is looking at is the terms of whether the settlement is fair, all of the things that are in both the preliminary and the other order that we're not going to talk about today. But that's the role of the trial court judge in overseeing a class action case, isn't it?
That is the role of the trial court judge. However, if the trial court judge asserts that we have no protectable legal interests, then I think that he has already stated that he is not going to be ensuring that it is fair towards our interests. And that's the legal error that we are asking for. I do want to address that it was stated that we were bringing up this issue involving the claim submissions for the first time. That is absolutely not the first time we mentioned it. It's in the trial court order. It's one of the footnotes where he describes the way in which we it's the footnote where he's talking about that we're going to be given outright awards doesn't change the nature of the analysis. That was in the trial court order. It is not forfeited or waived. I guess the other thing I want to say is that intervention is supposed to be freely granted. It's supposed to be one of those things where you want to get everyone who's got a potential interest in at the same time. This is one of those cases where it shouldn't have been particularly close. And Justice Edens, when you were asking, isn't it kind of ridiculous that they're saying that someone who says you don't have any rights is adequately representing your interests? The fact that the trial court bid on that is one of those instances where you can see that the mechanism is how to exclude us and then reasoning backwards. It was not an application of the law. It was not an attempt to apply the law to this particular procedure. And that's why we are asking this court to really take a look at it. And I think that the real thing that we want to get clear here is that a finding from you all that we have a protectable legal interest that we timely asserted and intervention was necessary is going to result in an actual global resolution of everything. And I remember I asked you all, we've never heard why the defendants would back out of the settlement if they aren't required to pay a dollar more, if they're not any worse off than they would have been in the event that we were shut out. They were up here, they left time on the table. No one has ever explained that. This will result in the global settlement. Everyone will get what they bargained for. The holdback fund will resolve all of our claims. That should be it. There's nothing bad that will happen as a result of allowing us to intervene, but there's a lot of negative downstream consequences of condoning this kind of subclass without rights that will come down the line. With that, there's no other questions. I'll leave my 20 seconds left.
Thank you. This court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki ike hanahano o kamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.